arms about him, careless of our presence, her eyes gleaming hungrily, that the change came. It came with a fierce and threatening shriek of wind, and a rattling of the casement, as if the horde of ghosts without was about to break in upon us. A long, quivering sigh escaped from Jessica's lips. Her arms fell from her husband's shoulders, and she drew back, swaying a little from side to side. "Paul!" she cried, and somehow the whole timbre of her voice was changed. "What a wretch I've been to bring you back to Blackwick, ill as you are. But we'll go away. Dear, yes, I'll go too. Oh, will you take me away? Take me away tomorrow." She spoke with an intense earnestness, unconscious all the time of what had been happening to her. Long shudders were convulsing her frame. "I don't know why I've wanted to stay here," she kept repeating. "I hate the place, really. It's evil, evil." Having heard these words, I exulted, for surely Vance's success was assured, but I was to learn that the danger was not yet past. Husband and wife separated, each going to their own room. I noticed the grateful, if mystified, glance that Davenant threw at Vance, vaguely aware, as he must have been, that my friend was somehow responsible for what had happened. It was settled that plans for departure were to be discussed on the morrow. "I have succeeded," Vance said hurriedly when we were alone. "But the change may be a transitory one. I must keep watch tonight. Go you to bed, Dexter. There is nothing that you can do." I obeyed, though I would sooner have kept watch, too, watch against a danger of which I had no understanding. I went to my room, a gloomy and sparsely furnished apartment, but I knew that it was quite impossible for me to think of sleeping, and so, dressed as I was, I went and sat by the open window, for now the wind that had raged around the castle had died down to a low moaning in the pine trees, a whimpering of a time-worn agony. And it was as I sat thus that I became aware of a white figure that stole out from the castle by a door that I could not see, and, with hands clasped, ran swiftly across the terrace to the wood. I had but a momentary glance, but I felt convinced that the figure was that of Jessica Davenant. And instinctively I knew that some great danger was imminent. It was, I think, the suggestion of despair conveyed by those clasped hands. At any rate, I did not hesitate. My window was some height from the ground, but the wall below was ivy-clad and afforded good foothold. The descent was quite easy. I achieved it, and was just in time to take up the pursuit in the right direction, which was into the thickness of the wood that clung to the slope of the hill. I shall never forget that wild chase. There was just sufficient room to enable me to follow the rough path, which, luckily, since I had now lost sight of my quarry, was the only possible way that she could have taken. There were no intersecting tracks, and the wood was too thick on either side to permit of deviation. And the wood seemed full of dreadful sounds, moaning and wailing and hideous laughter. The wind, of course, and the screaming of night birds. Once I felt the fluttering of wings in close proximity to my face. But I could not rid myself of the thought that I, in my turn, was being pursued, that the forces of hell were combined against me. The path came to an abrupt end on the border of the somber lake that I have already mentioned. And now I realized that I was indeed only just in time, for before me, plunging knee-deep in the water, I recognized the white-clad figure of the woman I had been pursuing. Hearing my footsteps, she turned her head, and then threw up her arms and screamed. Her red hair fell in heavy masses about her shoulders, and her face, as I saw it in the moment, was hardly human for the agony of remorse that it depicted. "Go!" she screamed. "For God's sake, let me die!" But I was by her side almost as she spoke. She struggled with me, sought vainly to tear herself from my clasp, implored me with panting breath to let her drown. "It's the only way to save him," she gasped. "Don't you understand that I'm a thing accursed? For it is I who have sapped his lifeblood. I know it now. The truth has been revealed to me tonight. I am a vampire, without hope in this world or the next. So for his sake, for the sake of his unborn child, let me die. Let me die!" Was ever so terrible an appeal made? Yet I, what could I do? Gently I overcame her resistance and drew her back to shore. By the time I reached it, she was lying a dead weight upon my arm. I laid her down upon a mossy bank, and kneeling by her side, gazed intently into her face. And then I knew that I had done well, for the face I looked upon was not that of Jessica the vampire, as I had seen in that afternoon. It was the face of Jessica, the woman whom Paul Davenant had loved. And later, Alma Vance had his tale to tell. "I waited," he said, "until I knew that Davenant was asleep, and then I stole into his room to watch by his bedside. And presently she came, as I guessed she would, the vampire, the accursed thing that has preyed upon the souls of her kin, making them like to herself when they too have passed into Shadowland, and gathering sustenance for her horrid task from the blood of those who are alien to her race. Paul's body and Jessica's soul, it is for one and the other, Dexter, that we have fought."
"You mean," I hesitated, "Zayda the witch?"
"Even so," he agreed. "Hers is the evil spirit that has fallen like a blight upon the house of MacThane, but now I think she may be exorcised forever.
Tell me."
"She came to Paul Davenant last night, as she must have done before in the guise of his wife. You know that Jessica bears a strong resemblance to her ancestress. He opened his arms, but she was foiled of her prey, for I had taken my precautions. I had placed that upon Davenant's breast while he slept, which robbed the vampire of her power of ill. She sped wailing from the room, a shadow, she who a minute before had looked at him with Jessica's eyes and spoken to him with Jessica's voice. Her red lips were Jessica's lips, and they were close to his when his eyes were opened, and he saw her as she was, a hideous phantom of the corruption of the ages. And so the spell was removed, and she fled away to the place whence she had come."
He paused. "And now?" I inquired.
"Blackwick Castle must be razed to the ground," he replied. "That is the only way. Every stone of it, every brick, must be ground to powder and burnt with fire, for therein is the cause of all the evil. Davenant has consented."
"And Mrs. Davenant?"
"I think," Vance answered cautiously, "that all may be well with her. The curse will be removed with the destruction of the castle. She has not, thanks to you, perished under its influence. She was less guilty than she imagined, herself preyed upon rather than praying. But can't you understand her remorse when she realized, as she was bound to realize, the part she had played, and the knowledge of the child to come, its fatal inheritance?"
"I understand," I muttered with a shudder.
And then, under my breath, I whispered, "Thank God."
Dracula's Guest by Bram Stoker. Bram Abraham Stoker, 1847 to 1912, was born in a seaside suburb of Dublin. He was extremely sickly as a child, his long bedridden hours made bearable by his mother's stories of horror, fictional, folklore, and real life, including grisly tales of the 1832 cholera epidemic in Sligo. His health improved when he went to school at 7, becoming a star athlete at Trinity College in Dublin. He began writing short fiction as well as theatre reviews for the Dublin Mail, which was partly owned by the famous writer of horror and supernatural fiction, Sheridan Le Fanu, then took the job of manager to Henry Irving, the most popular and acclaimed actor of his generation, a position Stoker held for 26 years of 18-hour working days. In spite of the debilitating schedule, Stoker was able to write more than a dozen novels and other works during his years managing Irving, including the most famous horror novel of the 19th century, Dracula, 1897. Dracula became both a critical and popular success, reprinted countless times. Freudian elements may have been at work in Stoker's subconscious, as he named the tireless vampire hunter Abraham Van Helsing, using his own first name, while Irving had the attributes of a psychic vampire, draining the life of the author with the relentless workload. Dracula's Guest was written as a chapter in Dracula that was never used. It was published for the first time in the posthumous Dracula's Guest and Other Stories, London, Routledge, 1914.
Dracula's Guest by Bram Stoker. Read by Simon Vance. When we started for our drive, the sun was shining brightly on Munich, and the air was full of the joyousness of early summer. Just as we were about to depart, Herr Delbruck, the maître d'hôtel of the Quatre Saisons, where I was staying, came down bareheaded to the carriage, and after wishing me a pleasant drive, said to the coachman, still holding his hand on the handle of the carriage door,
"Remember you are back by nightfall. The sky looks bright, but there is a shiver in the north wind that says there may be a sudden storm. But I am sure you will not be late."
Here he smiled and added, "For you know what night it is." Johann answered with an emphatic, "Ja, mein Herr," and touching his hat, drove off quickly. When he had cleared the town, I said, after signalling to him to stop, "Tell me, Johann, what is tonight?" He crossed himself, and he answered laconically, "Walpurgisnacht." Then he took out his watch, a great old-fashioned German silver thing as big as a turnip, and looked at it, with his eyebrows gathered together, and a little impatient shrug of his shoulders. I realized that this was his way of respectfully protesting against the unnecessary delay, and sank back in the carriage, merely motioning him to proceed. He started off rapidly, as if to make up for lost time. Every now and then the horses seemed to throw up their heads and sniffed the air suspiciously. On such occasions I often looked round in alarm. The road was pretty bleak, for we were traversing a sort of high, wind-swept plateau. As we drove, I saw a road that looked but little used, and which seemed to dip through a little winding valley. It looked so inviting that, even at the risk of offending him, I called Johann to stop, and when he had pulled up, I told him I would like to drive down that road. He made all sorts of excuses, and frequently crossed himself as he spoke. This somewhat piqued my curiosity, so I asked him various questions. He answered fencingly, and repeatedly looked at his watch in protest. Finally I said, "Well, Johann, I want to go down this road. I shall not ask you to come unless you like, but tell me why you do not like to go. That is all I ask." For answer he seemed to throw himself off the box, so quickly did he reach the ground. Then he stretched out his hands appealingly to me, and implored me not to go. There was just enough of English mixed with the German for me to understand the drift of his talk. He seemed always just about to tell me something, the very idea of which evidently frightened him, but each time he pulled himself up, saying as he crossed himself, "Walpurgisnacht!" I tried to argue with him, but it was difficult to argue with a man when I did not know his language. The advantage certainly rested with him, for although he began to speak in English of a very crude and broken kind, he always got excited and broke into his native tongue, and every time he did so he looked at his watch. Then the horses became restless and sniffed the air. At this he grew very pale, and looking around in a frightened way, he suddenly jumped forward, took them by the bridles, and led them on some 20 feet. I followed and asked why he had done this. For answer he crossed himself, pointed to the spot we had left, and drew his carriage in the direction of the other road, indicating a cross, and said, first in German, then in English,
"Buried him. Him what killed themselves."
I remember the old custom of burying suicides at crossroads. "Ah, I see, a suicide. How interesting." But for the life of me I could not make out why the horses were frightened. While we were talking we heard a sort of sound between a yelp and a bark. It was far away, but the horses got very restless, and it took Johann all his time to quiet them. He was pale and said,
"It sounds like a wolf. But yet there are no wolves here now."
"No," I said, questioning him. "Isn't it long since the wolves were so near the city?"
"Long, long," he answered, "in the spring and summer. But with the snow the wolves have been here not so long."
While he was petting the horses and trying to quiet them, dark clouds drifted rapidly across the sky. The sunshine passed away and a breath of cold wind seemed to drift past us. It was only a breath, however, and more in the nature of a warning than a fact, for the sun came out brightly again. Johann looked under his lifted hand at the horizon and said,
"The storm of snow! He comes before long time."
Then he looked at his watch again, and straightway holding his reins firmly, for the horses were still pawing the ground restlessly and shaking their heads, he climbed to his box as though the time had come for proceeding on our journey. I felt a little obstinate, and did not at once get into the carriage.
"Tell me," I said, "about this place where the road leads," and I pointed down.
Again he crossed himself and mumbled a prayer, before he answered,
"It is unholy."
"What is unholy?" I inquired.
"The village."
"Then there is a village?"
"No, no, No one lives there hundreds of years.
My curiosity was piqued. But you said there was a village.
There was.
Where is it now? Whereupon he burst out into a long story in German and English, so mixed up that I could not quite understand exactly what he said. But roughly I gathered that long ago, hundreds of years, men had died there and been buried in their graves, and sounds were heard under the clay. And when the graves were opened, men and women were found rosy with life and their mouths red with blood. And so, in haste to save their lives, aye, and their souls, and here he crossed himself, those who were left fled away to other places, where the living died, and the dead were dead, and not something. He was evidently afraid to speak the last words. As he proceeded with his narration, he grew more and more excited. It seemed as if his imagination had got hold of him, and he ended in a perfect paroxysm of fear, white-faced, perspiring, trembling, and looking round him, as if expecting that some dreadful presence would manifest itself there in the bright sunshine on the open plain. Finally, in an agony of desperation, he cried,
"Walpurgisnacht!"
and pointed to the carriage for me to get in. All my English blood rose at this, and standing back, I said, "You are afraid, Johann. You are afraid. Go home. I shall return alone. The walk will do me good." The carriage door was open. I took from the seat my oak walking stick, which I always carry on my holiday excursions, and closed the door, pointing back to Munich, and said, "Go home, Johann. Walpurgisnacht doesn't concern Englishmen." The horses were now more restive than ever, and Johann was trying to hold them in while excitedly imploring me not to do anything so foolish. I pitied the poor fellow, he was so deeply in earnest, but all the same I could not help laughing. His English was quite gone now. In his anxiety he had forgotten that his only means of making me understand was to talk my language, so he jabbered away in his native German. It began to be a little tedious. After giving the direction, "Home," I turned to go down the crossroad into the valley. With a despairing gesture, Johann turned his horses towards Munich. I leaned on my stick and looked after him. He went slowly along the road for a while. Then there came over the crest of the hill a man, tall and thin. I could see so much in the distance. When he drew near the horses, they began to jump and kick about, then to scream with terror. Johann could not hold them in. They bolted down the road, running away madly. I watched them out of sight, then looked for the stranger. But I found that he, too, was gone. With a light heart I turned down the side road through the deepening valley to which Johann had objected. There was not the slightest reason that I could see for his objection, and I dare say I tramped for a couple of hours without thinking of time or distance, and certainly without seeing a person or a house. So far as the place was concerned, it was desolation itself. But I did not notice this particularly till, on turning a bend in the road, I came upon a scattered fringe of wood. Then I recognized that I had been impressed unconsciously by the desolation of the region through which I had passed. I sat down to rest myself and began to look around. It struck me that it was considerably colder than it had been at the commencement of my walk. A sort of sighing sound seemed to be around me, with, now and then, high overhead, a sort of muffled roar. Looking upwards, I noticed that great thick clouds were drifting rapidly across the sky from north to south at a great height. There were signs of a coming storm in some lofty stratum of the air. I was a little chilly, and thinking that it was the sitting still after the exercise of walking, I resumed my journey. The ground I passed over was now much more picturesque. There were no striking objects that the eye might single out, but in all there was a charm and beauty. I took little heed of time, and it was only when the deepening twilight forced itself upon me that I began to think of how I should find my way home. The brightness of the day had gone. The air was cold, and the drifting of clouds high overhead was more marked. They were accompanied by a sort of faraway rushing sound, through which seemed to come at intervals that mysterious cry which the driver had said came from a wolf. For a while I hesitated. I had said I would see the deserted village, so on I went, and presently came on a wide stretch of open country, shut in by hills all around. Their sides were covered with trees which spread down to the plain, dotting in clumps the gentler slopes and hollows which showed here and there. I followed with my eye the winding of the road, and saw that it curved close to one of the densest of these clumps, and was lost behind it. As I looked, there came a cold shiver in the air, and the snow began to fall. I thought of the miles and miles of bleak country I had passed, and then hurried on to seek the shelter of the wood in front. Darker and darker grew the sky, and faster and heavier fell the snow, till the earth before and around me was a glistening white carpet, the further edge of which was lost in misty vagueness. The road was here, but crude, and when on the level its boundaries were not so marked as when it passed through the cuttings, and in a little while I found that I must have strayed from it, for I missed underfoot the hard surface, and my feet sank deeper in the grass and moss. Then the wind grew stronger and blew with ever-increasing force, till I was fain to run before it. The air became icy cold, and in spite of my exercise I began to suffer. The snow was now falling so thickly, and whirling around me in such rapid eddies, that I could hardly keep my eyes open. Every now and then the heavens were torn asunder by vivid lightning, and in the flashes I could see ahead of me a great mass of trees, chiefly yew and cypress, all heavily coated with snow. I was soon amongst the shelter of the trees, and there in comparative silence I could hear the rush of the wind high overhead. Presently the blackness of the storm had become merged in the darkness of the night. By and by the storm seemed to be passing away. It now only came in fierce puffs and blasts. At such moments the weird sound of the wolf appeared to be echoed by many similar sounds around me. Now and again, through the black mass of drifting cloud came a straggling ray of moonlight, which lit up the expanse and showed me that I was at the edge of a dense mass of cypress and yew trees. As the snow had ceased to fall, I walked out from the shelter and began to investigate more closely. It appeared to me that amongst so many old foundations as I had passed, there might be still standing a house in which, though in ruins, I could find some sort of shelter for a while. As I skirted the edge of the copse, I found that a low wall encircled it, and following this I presently found an opening. Here the cypresses formed an alley, leading up to a square mass of some kind of building. Just as I caught sight of this, however, the drifting clouds obscured the moon, and I passed up the path in darkness. The wind must have grown colder, for I felt myself shiver as I walked. But there was hope of shelter, and I groped my way blindly on. I stopped, for there was a sudden stillness. The storm had passed, and, perhaps in sympathy with nature's silence, my heart seemed to cease to beat. But this was only momentarily, for suddenly the moonlight broke through the clouds, showing me that I was in a graveyard, and that the square object before me was a great, massive tomb of marble, as white as the snow that lay on and all around it. With the moonlight there came a fierce sigh of the storm, which appeared to resume its course with a long, low howl, as of many dogs or wolves. I was awed and shocked, and felt the cold perceptibly grow upon me till it seemed to grip me by the heart. Then, while the flood of moonlight still fell on the marble tomb, the storm gave further evidence of renewing, as though it was returning on its track. Impelled by some sort of fascination, I approached the sepulchre to see what it was, and why such a thing stood alone in such a place. I walked around it and read, over the Doric door, in German, "Countess Dodingen of Graz, in Styria, sought and found death, 1801. On the top of the tomb, seemingly driven through the solid marble, for the structure was composed of a few vast blocks of stone, was a great iron spike, or stake. On going to the back, I saw, graven in great Russian letters, "The dead travel fast." There was something so weird and uncanny about the whole thing that it gave me a turn and made me feel quite faint. I began to wish for the first time that I had taken Johann's advice. Here a thought struck me, which came under almost mysterious circumstances and with a terrible shock. This was Walpurgis Night. Walpurgis Night, when, according to the belief of millions of people, the devil was abroad, when the graves were opened and the dead came forth and walked, when all evil things of earth and air and water held revel. This very place the driver had specially shunned. This was the depopulated village of centuries ago. This was where the suicide lay, and this was the place where I was alone, unmanned, shivering with cold in a shroud of snow, with a wild storm gathering again upon me. It took all my philosophy, all the religion I had been taught, all my courage, not to collapse in a paroxysm of fright. And now a perfect tornado burst upon me. The ground shook, as though thousands of horses thundered across it, and this time the storm bore on its icy wings not snow, but great hailstones which drove with such violence that they might have come from the thongs of Balearic slingers, hailstones that beat down leaf and branch and made the shelter of the cypresses of no more avail than though their stems were standing corn. At the first I had rushed to the nearest tree, but I was soon fain to leave it and seek the only spot that seemed to afford refuge, the deep Doric doorway of the marble tomb. There, crouching against the massive bronze door, I gained a certain amount of protection from the beating of the hailstones, for now they only drove against me as they ricocheted from the ground on the side of the marble. As I leaned against the door, it moved slightly, and opened inwards. The shelter of even a tomb was welcome in that pitiless tempest, and I was about to enter it when there came a flash of forked lightning that lit up the whole expanse of the heavens. In the instant, as I am a living man, I saw, as my eyes were turned into the darkness of the tomb, a beautiful woman with rounded cheeks and red lips, seemingly sleeping on a bier. As the thunder broke overhead, I was grasped as by the hand of a giant and hurled out into the storm. The whole thing was so sudden that, before I could realize the shock, moral as well as physical, I found the hailstones beating me down. At the same time I had a strange, dominating feeling that I was not alone. I looked towards the tomb. Just then there came another blinding flash which seemed to strike the iron stake that surmounted the tomb and to pour through to the earth, blasting and crumbling the marble as in a burst of flame. The dead woman rose for a moment of agony while she was lapped in the flame, and her bitter scream of pain was drowned in the thunder crash. The last thing I heard was this mingling of dreadful sound, as again I was seized in the giant grasp and dragged away, while the hailstones beat on me and the air around seemed reverberant with the howling of wolves. The last sight that I remembered was a vague, white, moving mass, as if all the graves around me had sent out the phantoms of their sheeted dead, and that they were closing in on me through the white cloudiness of the driving hail. Gradually there came a sort of vague beginning of consciousness, then a sense of weariness that was dreadful. For a time I remembered nothing, but slowly my senses returned. My feet seemed positively racked with pain, yet I could not move them. They seemed to be numbed. There was an icy feeling at the back of my neck and all down my spine, and my ears, like my feet, were dead, yet in torment. But there was in my breast a sense of warmth which was by comparison delicious. It was as a nightmare, if one may use such an expression, for some heavy weight on my chest made it difficult for me to breathe. This period of semi-lethargy seemed to remain a long time, and as it faded away I must have slept or swooned. Then came a sort of loathing, like the first stage of seasickness, and a wild desire to be free from something, I knew not what. A vast stillness enveloped me, as though all the world were asleep or dead, only broken by the low panting as of some animal close to me. I felt a warm rasping at my throat. Then came a consciousness of the awful truth, which chilled me to the heart and sent the blood surging up through my brain. Some great animal was lying on me and now licking my throat. I feared to stir, for some instinct of prudence bade me lie still, but the brute seemed to realize that there was now some change in me, for it raised its head. Through my eyelashes I saw above me the two great flaming eyes of a gigantic wolf. Its sharp white teeth gleamed in the gaping red mouth, and I could feel its hot breath fierce and acrid upon me. For another spell of time I remembered no more. Then I became conscious of a low growl, followed by a yelp renewed again and again. Then, seemingly very far away, I heard a "Halloa! Halloa!" as of many voices calling in unison. Cautiously I raised my head and looked in the direction whence the sound came, but the cemetery blocked my view. The wolf still continued to yelp in a strange way, and a red glare began to move round the grove of cypresses, as though following the sound. As the voices grew closer, the wolf yelped faster and louder. I feared to make either sound or motion. Nearer came the red glow, over the white pall which stretched into the darkness around me. Then all at once, from beyond the trees, there came at a trot a troop of horsemen bearing torches. The wolf rose from my breast and made for the cemetery. I saw one of the horsemen, soldiers by their caps and their long military cloaks, raise his carbine and take aim. A companion knocked up his arm, and I heard the ball whiz over my head. He had evidently taken my body for that of the wolf. Another sighted the animal as it slunk away, and a shot followed. Then, at a gallop, the troop rode forward, some towards me, others following the wolf as it disappeared amongst the snow-clad cypresses. As they drew nearer, I tried to move, but was powerless, although I could see and hear all that went on around me. Two or three of the soldiers jumped from their horses and knelt beside me. One of them raised my head and placed his hand over my heart.
"Good news, comrades," he cried. "His heart still beats."
Then some brandy was poured down my throat. It put vigour into me, and I was able to open my eyes fully and look around. Lights and shadows were moving among the trees, and I heard men call to one another. They drew together, uttering frightened exclamations, and the lights flashed as the others came pouring out of the cemetery pell-mell like men possessed. When the further ones came close to us, those who were around me asked them eagerly,
"Well, have you found him?"
The reply rang out hurriedly,
"No, no, come away, quick, quick. This is no place to stay, and on this of all nights."
"What was it?" was the question, asked in all manner of keys. The answer came variously and all indefinitely, as though the men were moved by some common impulse to speak, yet were restrained by some common fear from giving their thoughts.
"Indeed," gibbered one, whose wits had plainly given out for the moment. "A wolf, and yet not a wolf," another put in shudderingly.
"No use trying for him without the sacred bullet," a third remarked in a more ordinary manner.
"Serve us right for coming out on this night. Truly we have earned our 1,000 marks," were the ejaculations of a fourth.
"There was blood on the broken marble," another said after a pause. "The lightning never brought that there. And for him, is he safe? Look at his throat. See, comrades, the wolf has been lying on him and keeping his blood warm."
The officer looked at my throat and replied,
"He is all right. The skin is not pierced."
"What does it all mean? We should never have found him but for the yelping of the wolf."
"What became of it?" asked the man who was holding up my head, and who seemed the least panic-stricken of the party, for his hands were steady and without tremor.
On his sleeve was the chevron of a petty officer.
"It went to its home," answered the man, whose long face was pallid, and who actually shook with terror as he glanced around him fearfully. "There are graves enough there in which it may lie. Come, comrades, come quickly, let us leave this cursed spot."
The officer raised me to a sitting position as he uttered a word of command, then several men placed me upon a horse. He sprang to the saddle behind me, took me in his arms, gave the word to advance, and, turning our faces away from the cypresses, we rode away in swift military order. As yet my tongue refused its office, and I was perforce silent. I must have fallen asleep, for the next thing I remembered was finding myself standing up, supported by a soldier on each side of me. It was almost broad daylight, and to the north a red streak of sunlight was reflected, like a path of blood over the waste of snow. The officer was telling the men to say nothing of what they had seen, except that they found an English stranger guarded by a large dog.
"Dog? That was no dog," cut in the man who had exhibited such fear. "I think I know a wolf when I see one."
The young officer answered calmly, "I said a dog."
"Dog,"
reiterated the other ironically. It was evident that his courage was rising with the sun, and, pointing to me, he said,
"Look at his throat. Is that the work of a dog, master?"
Instinctively I raised my hand to my throat, and as I touched it I cried out in pain. The men crowded round to look, some stooping down from their saddles, and again there came the calm voice of the young officer.
"A dog, as I said. If aught else were said, we should only be laughed at."
I was then mounted behind a trooper, and we rode on into the suburbs of Munich. Here we came across a stray carriage, into which I was lifted, and it was driven off to the Quatre Saisons, the young officer accompanying me, while a trooper followed with his horse, and the others rode off to their barracks. When we arrived, Herr Delbruck rushed so quickly down the steps to meet me that it was apparent he had been watching within. Taking me by both hands, he solicitously led me in. The officer saluted me and was turning to withdraw when I recognized his purpose, and insisted that he should come to my rooms. Over a glass of wine I warmly thanked him and his brave comrades for saving me. He replied simply that he was more than glad, and that Herr Delbruck had at the first taken steps to make all the searching party pleased, at which ambiguous utterance the maître d'hôtel smiled, while the officer pleaded duty and withdrew.
"But, Herr Delbruck," I inquired, "how and why was it that the soldiers searched for me?"
He shrugged his shoulders, as if in depreciation of his own deed, as he replied,
I was so fortunate as to obtain leave from the commander of the regiment in which I served to ask for volunteers.
But how did you know I was lost? I asked.
The driver came hither with the remains of his carriage, which had been upset when the horses ran away.
But surely you would not send a search party of soldiers merely on this account?
Oh, no, he answered. But even before the coachman arrived, I had this telegram from the boyar whose guest you are.
And he took from his pocket a telegram which he handed to me, and I read, Bistritz. Be careful of my guest. His safety is most precious to me. Should aught happen to him, or if he be missed, spare nothing to find him and ensure his safety. He is English, and therefore adventurous. There are often dangers from snow and wolves and night. Lose not a moment if you suspect harm to him. I answer your zeal with my fortune. Dracula. As I held the telegram in my hand, the room seemed to whirl around me, and if the attentive maître d'hôtel had not caught me, I think I should have fallen. There was something so strange in all this, something so weird and impossible to imagine, that there grew on me a sense of my being in some way the sport of opposite forces, the mere vague idea of which seemed in a way to paralyze me. I was certainly under some form of mysterious protection. From a distant country had come, in the very nick of time, a message that took me out of the danger of the snow sleep and the jaws of the wolf.
The Transfer by Algernon Blackwood. Algernon Blackwood, 1869 to 1951, was born in southeast London and was educated at Wellington College, the Moravian Brotherhood, and the University of Edinburgh, studying Oriental religions and the occult, and joining several occult societies. He moved to Canada at the age of 20 and worked on a farm, then ran a hotel before moving to New York as a newspaper reporter for the New York Sun and the New York Times. He returned to England at the age of 36 to become a full-time writer. He was a prolific author of supernatural short stories, producing more than a dozen collections, plus 16 novels. He is probably best known for his many stories about a psychic detective, some of which were collected in John Silence, 1908. These tales had originally been submitted to his publisher as essays recounting his own true life experiences, but he was persuaded to turn them into fictional works. Silence is a stand-in for the author, then, which contributes to the intensity of the suspense. His most famous non-silent stories are the often anthologized The Willows, 1907, and Wendigo, 1910. He also wrote an autobiography of his early years, Episodes Before 30, 1923. The Transfer was first published in book form in Pan's Garden, London, Macmillan, 1912.
The Transfer by Algernon Blackwood, read by Susan Duerden. The child began to cry in the early afternoon, about 3 o'clock, to be exact. I remember the hour, because I had been listening with secret relief to the sound of the departing carriage. Those wheels fading into the distance down the gravel drive with Mrs. Freen and her daughter Gladys, to whom I was governess, meant for me some hours' welcome rest, and the June day was oppressively hot. Moreover, there was this excitement in the little country household that had told upon us all, but especially upon myself. This excitement, running delicately behind all the events of the morning, was due to some mystery, and the mystery was of course kept concealed from the governess. I had exhausted myself with guessing and keeping on the watch. For some deep and unexplained anxiety possessed me, so that I kept thinking of my sister's dictum that I was really much too sensitive to make a good governess, and that I should have done far better as a professional clairvoyant. Mr. Freen, Sr., Uncle Frank, was expected for an unusual visit from town about tea-time. That I knew. I also knew that his visit was concerned somehow with the future welfare of little Jamie, Gladys's 7-year-old brother. More than this, indeed, I never knew, and this missing link makes my story in a fashion incoherent, an important bit of the strange puzzle left out. I only gathered that the visit of Uncle Frank was of a condescending nature, that Jamie was told he must be upon his very best behaviour to make a good impression, and that Jamie, who had never seen his uncle, dreaded him horribly already in advance. Then, trailing thinly through the dying crunch of the carriage wheels this sultry afternoon, I heard the curious little wail of the child's crying, with the effect, wholly unaccountable, that every nerve in my body shot its bolt electrically, bringing me to my feet with a tingling of unequivocal alarm. Positively, the water ran into my eyes. I recalled his white distress that morning when told that Uncle Frank was motoring down for tea and that he was to be very nice indeed to him. It had gone into me like a knife. All through the day, indeed, had run this nightmare quality of terror and vision. "The man with the enormous face?" he had asked in a little voice of awe, and then gone speechless from the room in tears that no amount of soothing management could calm. That was all I saw, and what he meant by the enormous face gave me only a sense of vague presentiment. But it came as anticlimax somehow, a sudden revelation of the mystery and excitement that pulsed beneath the quiet of the stifling summer day. I feared for him, for of all that commonplace household I loved Jamie best, though professionally I had nothing to do with him. He was a high-strung, ultra-sensitive child, and it seemed to me that no one understood him, least of all his honest, tender-hearted parents, so that his little wailing voice brought me from my bed to the window in a moment like a call for help. The haze of June lay over that big garden like a blanket. The wonderful flowers, which were Mr. Freen's delight, hung motionless. The lawns, so soft and thick, cushioned all other sounds. Only the limes and huge clumps of guelder roses hummed with bees. Through this muted atmosphere of heat and haze, the sound of the child's crying floated faintly to my ears, from a distance. Indeed, I wonder now that I heard it at all, for the next moment I saw him down beyond the garden, standing in his white sailor suit alone, 200 yards away. He was down by the ugly patch where nothing grew, the forbidden corner. A faintness then came over me at once, a faintness as of death, when I saw him there, of all places, where he never was allowed to go, and where, moreover, he was usually too terrified to go. To see him standing solitary in that singular spot, above all to hear him crying there, bereft me momentarily of the power to act. Then, before I could recover my composure sufficiently to call him in, Mr. Freen came round the corner from the lower farm with the dogs, and, seeing his son, performed that office for me. In his loud, good-natured, hearty voice, he called him, and Jamie turned and ran as though some spell had broken just in time, ran into the open arms of his fond but uncomprehending father, who carried him indoors on his shoulder while asking what all this hubbub was about. And, at their heels, the tailless sheepdogs followed, barking loudly, and performing what Jamie called their gravel dance, because they ploughed up the moist, rolled gravel with their feet. I stepped back swiftly from the window, lest I should be seen. Had I witnessed the saving of the child from fire or drowning, the relief could hardly have been greater. Only Mr. Freen, I felt sure, would not say and do the right thing quite. He would protect the boy from his own vain imaginings, yet not with the explanation that could really heal. They disappeared behind the rose trees, making for the house. I saw no more till later, when Mr. Freen Senior arrived. To describe the ugly patch as singular is hard to justify, perhaps, yet some such word is what the entire family sought, though never, oh, never, used. To Jamie and myself, though equally we never mentioned it, that treeless, flowerless spot was more than singular. It stood at the far end of the magnificent rose garden, a bald, sore place where the black earth showed uglily in winter, almost like a piece of dangerous bog, and in summer baked and cracked with fissures where green lizards shot their fire in passing. in contrast to the rich luxuriance of death amid life, a centre of disease that cried for healing lest it spread. But it never did spread. Behind it stood the thick wood of silver birches and, glimmering beyond, the orchard meadow, where the lambs played. The gardeners had a very simple explanation of its barrenness, that the water all drained off it, owing to the lie of the slopes immediately about it, holding no remnant to keep the soil alive. I cannot say. It was Jamie who felt its spell and haunted it, who spent whole hours there, even while afraid, and for whom it was finally labelled strictly out of bounds, because it stimulated his already big imagination, not wisely, but too darkly. It was Jamie who buried ogres there, and heard it crying in an earthly voice, swore that it shook its surface sometimes while he watched it, and secretly gave it food in the form of birds or mice or rabbits he found dead upon his wanderings. And it was Jamie who put so extraordinarily into words the feeling that the horror spot had given me from the moment I first saw it. "It's bad, Miss Gould," he told me. "But, Jamie, nothing in nature is bad. Exactly. Only different from the rest sometimes. Miss Gould, if you please, then it's empty. It's not fed. It's dying because it can't get the food it wants." And when I stared into the little pale face where the eyes shone so dark and wonderful, seeking within myself the right thing to say to him, he added, with an emphasis and conviction that made me suddenly turn cold, "Miss Gould." He always used my name like this in all his sentences. "It's hungry, don't you see? But I know what would make it feel all right." Only the conviction of an earnest child, perhaps, could have made so outrageous a suggestion worth listening to for an instant. But for me, who felt that things an imaginative child believed were important, it came with a vast, disquieting shock of reality. Jamie, in this exaggerated way, had caught at the edge of a shocking fact. A hint of dark, undiscovered truth had leaped into the sensitive imagination. Why there lay horror in the words, I cannot say, but I think some power of darkness trooped across the suggestion of that sentence at the end. "I know what would make it feel all right." I remember that I shrank from asking explanation. Small groups of other words, veiled fortunately by his silence, gave life to an unspeakable possibility that hitherto had lain at the back of my own consciousness. The way it sprang to life proves, I think, that my mind already contained it. The blood rushed from my heart as I listened. I remember that my knees shook. Jamie's idea was, had been all along, my own as well. And now, as I lay down on my bed and thought about it all, I understood why the coming of his uncle involved somehow an experience that wrapped terror in its heart. With a sense of nightmare certainty that left me too weak to resist the preposterous idea, too shocked indeed to argue or reason it away, this certainty came with its full black blast of conviction. And the only way I can put it into words, since nightmare horror really is not properly tellable at all, seems this: that there was something missing in that dying patch of garden, something lacking that it ever searched for, something once found and taken that would turn it rich and living as the rest. More, that there was some living person who could do this for it. Mr. Freen Sr. In a word, Uncle Frank was this person who out of his abundant life could supply the lack, unwittingly. For this connection between the dying, empty patch and the person of this vigorous, wealthy, and successful man had already lodged itself in my subconscious before I was aware of it. Clearly, it must have lain there all along, though hidden. Jamie's words, his sudden pallor, his vibrating emotion of fearful anticipation had developed the plate, but it was his weeping alone there in the forbidden corner that had printed it. The photograph shone framed before me in the air. I hid my eyes, but for the redness, The charm of my face goes to pieces unless my eyes are clear. I could have cried. Jamie's words that morning about the enormous face came back upon me like a battering ram. Mr. Freen, Sr., had been so frequently the subject of conversation in the family since I came. I had so often heard him discussed, and had then read so much about him in the papers, his energy, his philanthropy, his success with everything he laid his hand to, that a picture of the man had grown complete within me. I knew him as he was, within, or, as my sister would have said, clairvoyantly. And the only time I saw him, when I took Gladys to a meeting where he was chairman, and later felt his atmosphere and presence while for a moment he patronizingly spoke with her, had justified the portrait I had drawn. The rest, you may say, was a woman's wild imagining. But I think rather it was that kind of divining intuition which women share with children. If souls could be made visible, I would stake my life upon the truth and accuracy of my portrait. For this Mr. Freen was a man who drooped alone, but grew vital in a crowd, because he used their vitality. He was a supreme, unconscious artist in the science of taking the fruits of others' work and living for his own advantage. He vampired, unknowingly no doubt, everyone with whom he came in contact, left them exhausted, tired, listless. Others fed him, so that while in a full room he shone, alone by himself and with no life to draw upon, he languished and declined. In the man's immediate neighbourhood you felt his presence draining you. He took your ideas, your strength, your very words, and later used them for his own benefit and aggrandisement. Not evilly, of course. The man was good enough. But you felt that he was dangerous, owing to the facile way he absorbed into himself all loose vitality that was to be had. His eyes and voice and presence devitalized you. Life, it seemed, not highly organized enough to resist, must shrink from his too near approach, and hide away for fear of being appropriated, for fear, that is, of death. Jamie, unknowingly, put in the finishing touch to my unconscious portrait. The man carried about with him some silent, compelling trick of drawing out all your reserves, then swiftly pocketing them. At first you would be conscious of taut resistance. This would slowly shade off into weariness. The will would become flaccid. Then you either moved away or yielded, agreed to all he said with a sense of weakness pressing ever closer upon the edges of collapse. With a male antagonist, it might be different, but even then the effort of resistance would generate force that he absorbed and not the other. He never gave out. Some instinct taught him how to protect himself from that. To human beings, I mean, he never gave out. This time, it was a very different matter. He had no more chance than a fly before the wheels of a huge, what Jamie used to call, a traction engine. So this was how I saw him, a great human sponge, crammed and soaked with the life, or proceeds of life, absorbed from others, stolen. My idea of a human vampire was satisfied. He went about carrying these accumulations of the life of others. In this sense, his life was not really his own. For the same reason, I think, it was not so fully under his control as he imagined. And in another hour, this man would be here. I went to the window. My eye wandered to the empty patch. Dull black there amid the rich luxuriance of the garden flowers. It struck me as a hideous bit of emptiness, yawning to be filled and nourished. The idea of Jamie playing round its bare edges was loathsome. I watched the big summer clouds above, the stillness of the afternoon, the haze. The silence of the overheated garden was oppressive. I had never felt a day so stifling, motionless. It lay there waiting. The household, too, was waiting, waiting for the coming of Mr. Freen from London in his big motor car. And I shall never forget the sensation of icy shrinking and distress with which I heard the rumble of the car. He had arrived. Tea was already on the lawn beneath the lime trees, and Mrs. Freen and Gladys, back from their drive, were sitting in wicker chairs. Mr. Freen, Jr., was in the hall to meet his brother, but Jamie, as I learned afterwards, had shown such hysterical alarm, offered such bold resistance, that it had been deemed wiser to keep him in his room. Perhaps, after all, his presence might not be necessary. The visit clearly had to do with something on the uglier side of life, money, settlements, or what not. I never knew exactly, only that his parents were anxious and that Uncle Frank had to be propitiated. It does not matter. That has nothing to do with the affair. What has to do with it, or I should not be telling the story, is that Mrs. Freen sent for me to come down, in my nice white dress if I didn't mind, and that I was terrified, yet pleased, because it meant that a pretty face would be considered a welcome addition to the visitor's landscape. Also, most odd it was, I felt my presence was somehow inevitable, that in some way it was intended that I should witness what I did witness. And the instant I came upon the lawn, I hesitate to set it down, it sounds so foolish, disconnected, I could have sworn, as my eyes met his, that a kind of sudden darkness came, taking the summer brilliance out of everything, and it was caused by troops of small black horses that raced about us from his person, to attack. After a first momentary approving glance, he took no further notice of me. The tea and talk went smoothly. I helped to pass the plates and cups, filling in pauses with little undertalk to Gladys. Jamie was never mentioned. Outwardly all seemed well, but inwardly everything was awful. Skirting the edge of things unspeakable, and so charged with danger that I could not keep my voice from trembling when I spoke. I watched his hard, bleak face. I noticed how thin he was, and the curious, oily brightness of his steady eyes. They did not glitter, but they drew you with a sort of soft, creamy shine, like eastern eyes. And everything he said or did announced what I may dare to call the suction of his presence. His nature achieved this result automatically. He dominated us all, yet so gently that until it was accomplished, no one noticed it. Before 5 minutes had passed, however, I was aware of one thing only. My mind focused exclusively upon it, and so vividly that I marvelled the others did not scream or run or do something violent to prevent it. And it was this, that separated merely by some dozen yards or so, this man, vibrating with the acquired vitality of others, stood within easy reach of that spot of yawning emptiness, waiting and eager to be filled. Earth scented her prey. These two active centres were within fighting distance. He so thin, so hard, so keen, yet really spreading large with the loose surround of others' life he had appropriated, so practised and triumphant. That other so patient, deep, with so mighty a draw of the whole earth behind it, and, oh, so obviously aware that its opportunity at last had come. I saw it all as plainly as though I watched two great animals prepare for battle, both unconsciously. Yet in some inexplicable way I saw it, of course, within me, and not externally. The conflict would be hideously unequal. Each side had already sent out emissaries. How long before I could not tell, for the first evidence he gave that something was going wrong with him was when his voice grew suddenly confused. He missed his words, and his lips trembled a moment and turned flabby. The next second his face betrayed that singular and horrid change, growing somehow loose about the bones of the cheek, and larger, so that I remembered Jamie's miserable phrase. The emissaries of the two kingdoms, the human and the vegetable, had met, I make it out, in that very second. For the first time in his long career of battening on others, Mr. Freen found himself pitted against a vaster kingdom than he knew, and, so finding, shook inwardly in that little part that was his definite, actual self. He felt the huge disaster coming. "Yes, John," he was saying in his drawling, self-congratulating voice. "Sir George gave me that car. Gave it to me as a present. Wasn't it, Char?" And then broke off abruptly, stammered, drew breath, stood up, and looked uneasily about him. For a second there was a gaping pause. It was like the click which starts some huge machinery moving, that instant's pause before it actually starts. The whole thing, indeed, then went with the rapidity of machinery running down and beyond control. I thought of a giant dynamo working silently and invisible. "What's that?" he cried in a soft voice charged with alarm. "What's that horrid place? And someone's crying there. Who is it?" He pointed to the empty patch. Then, before anyone could answer, he started across the lawn towards it, going every minute faster. Before anyone could move, he stood upon the edge. He leaned over, peering down into it. It seemed a few hours passed, but really they were seconds, for time is measured by the quality and not the quantity of sensations it contains. I saw it with all merciless, photographic detail, sharply etched amid the general confusion. Each side was intensely active, but only one side, the human, exerted all its force in resistance. The other merely stretched out a feeler, as it were, from its vast, potential strength. No more was necessary. It was such a soft and easy victory. Oh, it was rather pitiful. There was no bluster or great effort, on one side at least. Close by his side, I witnessed it, for I, it seemed, alone had moved and followed him. No one else stirred, although Mrs. Freen clattered noisily with the cups, making some sudden impulsive gesture with her hands, and Gladys, I remember, gave a cry. It was like a little scream. "Oh, Mother, it's the heat, isn't it?" Mr. Freen, her father, was speechless, pale as ashes. But the instant I reached his side, it became clear what had drawn me there thus instinctively. Upon the other side, among the silver birches, stood little Jamie. He was watching. I experienced, for him, one of those moments that shake the heart. A liquid fear ran all over me, the more effective because unintelligible, really. Yet I felt that if I could know all, and what lay actually behind, my fear would be more than justified. That the thing was awful, full of awe. And then it happened. A truly wicked sight. Like watching a universe in action, yet all contained within a small square foot of space. I think he understood vaguely that if someone could only take his place, he might be saved. And that was why, discerning instinctively the easiest substitute within reach, he saw the child and called aloud to him across the empty patch. "James, my boy, come here." His voice was like a thin report, but somehow flat and lifeless, as when a rifle misses fire, sharp, yet weak. It had no crack in it. It was really supplication. And, with amazement, I heard my own ring out imperious and strong, though I was not conscious of saying it. "Jamie, don't move! Stay where you are!" But Jamie, the little child, obeyed neither of us. Moving up nearer to the edge, he stood there, laughing. I heard that laughter, but could have sworn it did not come from him. The empty, yawning patch gave out that sound. Mr. Freen turned sideways, throwing up his arms. I saw his hard, bleak face grow somehow wider, spread through the air and downwards. A similar thing, I saw, was happening at the same time to his entire person, for it drew out into the atmosphere in a stream of movement. The face, for a second made me think of those toys of green Indian rubber that children pull. It grew enormous. But this was an external impression only. What actually happened, I clearly understood, was that all this vitality and life he had transferred from others to himself for years was now, in turn, being taken from him and transferred elsewhere. One moment on the edge he wobbled horribly. Then, with that queer sideways motion, rapid yet ungainly, he stepped forward into the middle of the patch and fell heavily upon his face. His eyes, as he dropped, faded shockingly, and across the countenance was written plainly what I can only call an expression of destruction. He looked utterly destroyed. I caught a sound from Jamie, but this time not of laughter. It was like a gulp. It was deep and muffled, and it dipped away into the earth. Again I thought of a troop of small black horses galloping away down a subterranean passage beneath my feet, plunging into the depths, their tramping growing fainter and fainter into buried distance. In my nostrils was a pungent smell of earth. And then all passed. I came back into myself. Mr. Freen, Jr. was lifting his brother's head from the lawn where he had fallen from the heat, close beside the tea table. He had never really moved from there. And Jamie, I learned afterwards, had been the whole time asleep upon his bed upstairs, worn out with his crying and unreasoning alarm. Gladys came running out with cold water, sponge and towel, brandy too, all kinds of things.
"Mother, it was the heat, wasn't it?"
I heard her whisper, but I did not catch Mrs. Freen's reply. From her face it struck me that she was bordering on collapse herself. Then the butler followed, and they just picked him up and carried him into the house. He recovered even before the doctor came. But the queer thing to me is that I was convinced the others all had seen what I saw, only that no one said a word about it. And to this day, no one has said a word. And that was, perhaps, the most horrid part of all. From that day to this, I have scarcely heard a mention of Mr. Freen, Sr. It seemed as if he dropped suddenly out of life. The papers never mentioned him. His activities ceased, as it were. His afterlife, at any rate, became singularly ineffective. Certainly he achieved nothing worth public mention. But it may be only that, having left the employ of Mrs. Freen, there was no particular occasion for me to hear anything. The afterlife of that empty patch of garden, however, was quite otherwise. Nothing, so far as I know, was done to it by the gardeners, or in the way of draining it or bringing in new earth. But even before I left in the following summer, it had changed. It lay untouched, full of great, luscious, driving weeds and creepers, very strong, full-fed, and bursting thick with life.
The Stone Chamber by H.B. Marriott Watson. Henry Brereton Marriott Watson, 1863-1921, was born in Caulfield, Melbourne, Australia, and moved in New Zealand at the age of 10 when his Anglican minister father was made incumbent at St. John's in Christchurch. He was educated there, then moved to England permanently in 1883, becoming a journalist. He was the assistant editor of Black and White and the Pall Mall Gazette, and fiction writer under the tutelage of W. E. Henley. He became a prolific novelist and short story writer, mainly of swashbuckling adventure tales and historical romances, and was one of the most successful writers of this type of fiction in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. Silent films of his work are A Conspiracy Against the King, 1911, Her Face, 1912, Stanton's Last Fling, 1913, On the Isle of Same, 1914, and Romance at Random, 1916. Although they were never married, Watson had a long partnership with the decadent poet who took his name, Rosamund Marriott Watson, until her death from cancer in 1911. Their only son was killed in World War I. Not known as a writer of supernatural fiction, Watson nonetheless produced numerous short stories in this genre, two of which, The Present Story and The Devil of the Marsh, have become classics. The Stone Chamber was first published in book form in The Heart of Miranda, London, John Lane, 1899.
The Stone Chamber by H.B. Marriott Watson, read by Peter Altshuler. It was not until early summer that Warrington took possession of Marvin Abbey. He had bought the property in the preceding autumn, but the place had so fallen into decay through the disorders of time that more than 6 months elapsed ere it was inhabitable. The delay, however, fell out conveniently for Warrington, for the Bosanquets spent the winter abroad, and nothing must suit but he must spend it with them. There was never a man who pursued his passion with such ardour. He was ever at Miss Bosanquet's skirts, and bade fair to make her as steadfast a husband as he was attached a lover. Thus it was not until after his return from that prolonged exile that he had the opportunity of inspecting the repairs discharged by his architect. He was nothing out of the common in character, but was full of kindly impulses and a fellow of impetuous blood. When he called upon me in my chambers, he spoke with some excitement of his abbey, as also of his approaching marriage, and finally, breaking into an exhibition of genuine affection, declared that we had been so long and so continuously intimate that I, and none other, must help him warm his house and marry his bride. It had indeed been always understood between us that I should serve him at the ceremony, but now it appeared that I must start my duties even earlier. The prospect of a summer holiday in Utterburn pleased me. It was a charming village, set upon the slope of a wooded hill and within call of the sea. I had a slight knowledge of the district from a riding excursion taken through that part of Devonshire, and years before, and ere Warrington had come into his money, had viewed the abbey ruins from a distance with the polite curiosity of a passing tourist. I examined them now with new eyes as we drove up the avenue. The face which the ancient building presented to the valley was of magnificent design, but now much worn and battered. Part of it, the right wing, I judged to be long past the uses of a dwelling, for the walls had crumbled away, huge gaps opened in the foundations, and the roof was quite dismantled. Warrington had very wisely left this portion to its own sinister decay. It was the left wing which had been restored and which we were to inhabit. The entrance, I will confess, was a little mean, for the large doorway had been bricked up and an ordinary modern door gave upon the spacious terrace and the winding gardens. But, apart from this, the work of restoration had been undertaken with skill and piety, and the interior had retained its native dignity while resuming an air of proper comfort. The old oak had been repaired congruous with the original designs, and the great rooms had been as little altered as was requisite to adapt them for daily use. Warrington passed quickly from chamber to chamber in evident delight, directing my attention upon this and upon that, and eagerly requiring my congratulations and approval. My comments must have satisfied him, for the place attracted me vastly. The only criticism I ventured was to remark upon the size of the rooms and to question if they might dwarf the insignificant human figures they were to entertain. He laughed. "Not a bit," said he. "Roaring fires in winter in those fine old fireplaces, and as for summer, the more space the better. We shall be jolly." I followed him along the noble hall, and we stopped before a small door of very black oak. "The bedrooms," he explained as he turned the key, "are all upstairs. But mine's not ready yet, and besides, I'm reserving it. I won't sleep in it till, you understand," he concluded with a smiling suggestion of embarrassment. I understood very well. He threw the door open. "I'm going to use this in the meantime," he continued. "Queer little room, isn't it? Used to be a sort of library. How do you think it looks?" We had entered as he spoke and stood, distributing our glances in that vague and general way in which a room is surveyed. It was a chamber of much smaller proportions than the rest, and was dimly lighted by two long, narrow windows sunk in the great walls. The bed and the modern fittings looked strangely out of keeping with its ancient privacy. The walls were rudely distempered with barbaric frescoes dating, I conjectured, from the 14th century, and the floor was of stone, worn into grooves and hollows with the feet of many generations. As I was taking in these facts, there came over me a sudden curiosity as to those dead Marvins who had held the abbey for so long. This silent chamber seemed to suggest questions of their history. It spoke eloquently of past ages and past deeds, fallen now into oblivion. Here, within these thick walls,